DM Hotel. Hotel. Okay. I'd like to say thanks very much to Brother Hosley and Sister Ratabisha for such a glowing introduction. I am indeed humbled, and I'm appreciative of their recognition of what I'm trying to do. And if I touch lives, then that is my reward. I am honoring the formula that Brother and Dr. Jacob Carruthers says is the formula for reciprocity, that is D.F. Unk. He gives life, therefore we are obligated to return what we can to make the world a better world. I bring greetings from the Institute of Pan-African Studies and my other organization, US, a child of the fire and the audaciousness of the 60s, which just celebrated its 21st anniversary of this month. We say welcome, you found your family in a peaceful place, and we stand in the ranks of those who dare to rescue and reconstruct our history and humanity and shape it in our own image and interest. All right. Tonight I would like to talk about Martian spirituality and ethics. Of all the things that Kemet has given the world, calendar, art, literature, math, astronomy, and so many other things, nothing is more important than its gift of spirituality and ethics, which are expression of that spirituality. What do I mean by spirituality? I mean a profound emotional and rational appreciation for the transcendent and for the highest values of humankind, and then a corresponding commitment to practice those values. So we have focus on the transcendent, that which is beyond, that which is beyond what we see in front of us, that which is beyond our small selves, that which is even beyond us as a people, the transcendent, the highest values of humankind, that which recognizes our ascendant possibilities and gives us a road map to reach them. And ethics, what do I mean by ethics? That which is inherent in spirituality and which at the same time contains spirituality, ethics has two meanings. First, it's a system of morals, of standards of right and wrong, of worth and obligation. In other words, morals become standards that tell you what is right, what is wrong, and what has worth, and what is your obligation. We can't walk through the world without knowing what's right or wrong. So a lot of people think they're doing right and doing wrong. That is why it's important for the European to establish culture hegemony, dominance in views and values, so he can dictate wrong as if it were right and make people swear they're doing the best. In fact, when people saw The Color Purple, they were viewing it with standards that were supposed to be right, but on closer inspection turned out to be wrong. It was a self-destroying, self-destructive exercise, and so much so that black people didn't even realize in many cases that it was happening. I'm talking about having a standard of your own, regardless of what the Europeans said. But you say, well, Marlon, I was thinking when I saw it, if you like it, you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. You say, I saw it and I liked it. I got a mind. What is this? But do you understand that there is a process going on in the world now called the westernization of human consciousness? Right. Not just with Negroes, not just with black people, but with the world. Right. Whether it's in Japan or China, Africa, Asia, Latin America, the white man is dictating mental processes. In fact, even the concept Western is wrong and fits within his framework. To call the white man the Western man is to eliminate the Indian, the Hawaiian, and double O soul. We in the West. Look how that a white man divide the world up into East and West. And one of them the East and the other is the West. Now look at them calling the other white men, the Russians, the East. What's going on with the rest of the people in the East? Without a standard of what is wrong and right, without a standard of what is of worth and value, and without a standard that dictates obligation, What we do is submit to it even unconsciously, and that's the worst kind. And in the area of spirituality and ethics, we have not always been right. Not because we don't believe, tell the truth, don't kill people, honor your father and mother. That's, but you got to know where that came from. It's the other stuff that goes along with it that throws you off. And I'm asking tonight, can we have a central value system that is ours without Western mythology? And by mythology, I mean both secular and sacred. Like wig-wearing, silk-stocking-wearing George Washington throwing a quarter across the Delaware. That's secular mythology.
Yeah. Break it on down.
Sacred mythology is that sand dwellers are the chosen people. That the sand dwellers brought us a book we already had.
Oh,
some cattle grazers that we let graze on the edge of our fields comes up and declares them more in contact with our God than we are. We just went right along with it. Now, some of this is very difficult to deal with because it's like watching The Color Purple. When your mind has been westernized, you don't even recognize that's your mama they're talking about. You don't recognize that is your brother and father they're talking about. In fact, that's you. And that when they had a clip from The Color Purple on television every night saying that a prototypical West African-looking woman called Whoopi Goldberg was ugly, they were talking about you. You got to realize that. You also got to realize that there's no great honor in savages in the black man. Because if the black, that's a dialectic here. Because if the black man is a pimp, then the black woman is a hoe. Since that's who's pimping her, and she's hoeing for him. So we got to make up our mind what we want to do. If the man is a brute, we're a brute lover, says the sister. What are you into brutism for? We got to be honest about what's going on here. You understand? And I'm doing this preparatory little introduction because without laying the groundwork, what I say won't have the same effect. The African proverb says no matter how well a house is built, how high it's built, it's got to stand on something. What I'm trying to do is lay down foundation.
All right.
So you can see the importance of not walking in the pale shadow of the oppressor. You'll never really accept ancient Egyptian spirituality, never really accept the totality of your culture until you actually have a rupture. Mentally, culturally, and emotionally with the dominant society. And that means on all levels. Do you understand that? It is embarrassing for people to believe they're the first people. And then they existed thousands and thousands of years before the coming of the white man. And they believe God never said nothing to them. And if he did, they can't remember it. It's not a preacher you know that don't claim they have a word from God. Is that fair to say? And if he got a word for God now, why didn't the ancestors do it? And if they got it before the sand dwellers, why do we need the sand dwellers to tell us what our relationship with God should be? What I want to do is just run over some things that are going to sound familiar to you, but they are thousands of years older than the source you're familiar with from which they come. I want to talk ethics, okay? And I think ethics are important. Dr. Bishop mentioned that I was going back to school to get my second doctorate in ethics. Why is that? I mean, why don't I just be satisfied with my own laurels? You understand what I mean? Because I'm never satisfied with myself. Because I take my teaching serious. If I say I'm in the image of God, there's no limit to what I can do and what I ought to do. Second, because I see ethical dialogue, ethical discourse, as a critical discourse for decades to come. I believe that all the major issues will eventually be phrased in moral terms. And if we don't have a moral or ethical position on them, we're going to be left to the side. And the cold part about that is that that greatest gift to the world, not only is that chemist's greatest gift, that's Afro-America's greatest gift, the spiritual legacy. For years, since we got here, we've set the moral and progressive agenda for America. But it hasn't been intellectualized. But it hasn't been intellectualized. It's not down. Where's the book on black ethics? White man, he got books on white biomedics. Whether you see white or not, when you see anything that he wrote, it's white in front of white biomedics. White biomedical ethics. Do you understand that? Nuclear ethics, teaching ethics, even computer ethics. Every social question is being framed in an ethical manner. And I just wrote an article in the Black Scholar. Get the issue of Black Scholar. Be out the first week in October. In which I take apart the neoconservatives who have a fake moralism and begin to talk about black people like they had tails. Glenn Lowry, Walter Williams, Thomas Sowell. Glenn Lowry is the star now. But his reasoning is faulty. But who will make an ethical challenge of the moralism, and I'm using moralism as a derogatory, you know, like hypocritical kind of abduction and development with morality. You understand what I mean? I'm not talking morality. He ain't talking morality. He's talking moralism. Blood got to, yeah, the white man might be guilty. He said, but still, it's your responsibility. Now, that really sounds sometimes like what the nationalists say.
Yeah.
But see, it's a whole lot of difference in that. Listen to this. The white man has gotten the black neoconservative to frame criticism of us. We who introduce him to morality. Not just in ancient world, but now. We're the moral conscience of America. Do you know any other country has got? Listen. They now have the right wing, the moral majority, the right wing, has begun to couch its racism in moral terms. Now, nobody sitting here can deny that there are some disorders in the black community. Yeah. But at the same time, there's disorders in the world. That's right. That disorders where white it lives. Pardon me, where the white man lives.
And woman.
And woman. Well, white man and woman, is there any difference?
No.
In more ways than one. But true. Yeah. Somebody needs to say these things haven't been said since the 60s. People done cleaned up their language. What is cleaning up one's language? Is that morally compelling? Let me just tell, it's two or three things I want to say. I mean, I'm still in Egypt. Did you understand that? Do you understand that if I don't have grounding in Egypt, I can't make the kind of criticism I do morally of the European because I'd be working from his own framework.
All right.
Now listen to them. Glenn Lowry says, just listen to this now. Glenn Lowry says, regardless of what the white man did to you, you're still responsible and the white man's not responsible for your freedom. Yeah. I've said this all along, you know. The white man's guilty of our enslavement, but we're responsible for the race, remember? That sounds the same, but it's not. First of all, it's different because I'm not wishy-washy about what the white man did to us. The white man committed against us the greatest and longest-lasting Holocaust in human history. That's a criminal act of historic proportion. If the white man is a criminal by all moral and juridical concepts existent, the criminal is not only at fault, he's also responsible for restitution through compensation and correction.
Right.
expect white man to do nothing about this without us forcing him to. This is what Frederick Douglass meant when he said, power concedes nothing without demand, never did, never will. And the struggle may be a moral or a physical one or both, but it must be struggle. Do you understand that? So we are ultimately responsible, but part of our responsibility is to hold him accountable. This is morally compelling on us. Do you understand that? It is defense of our history and humanity. He doesn't have the right to get away with what he did to us. And concentrating on us and our disorder is no excuse for what he did. The white man can murder 10 people and say, hey, some of them killed themselves. Oh, this is what Israel's doing in Lebanon. Talking about the Arabs are killing each other. Therefore, I drop bomb, don't call me nothing. White man's always, you and I always escape responsibility. But then want you to understand his Holocaust and want to hold the Germans responsible. Right. Why don't they make this argument about German restitution? Reparations is an established international thing. And what we got to do is develop a more argument for it. Now, that is one last point, and then I'm going to get on into the heart of the Hasidic teaching. But I need to lay this down, otherwise, you know, don't be real. It'd be like hanging out there. Do you understand? Listen, you haven't noticed it, but in all this conversation that the right has started up, black people have lost their moral bearings. Not just by taking dope, not just by shooting each other and having a lot of babies out of wedlock, not all that. Teenage children having children, not all that. That's a little disorderly, isn't it? Be honest now, you got to be self-critical. But you got to speak your own truth, not let the white man do. Because you got a different motive for speaking. And truth is whole. It's not just half or one-fourth what the white man speaks. When he says it, he talks a half-truth. He says, you got a disorder. The whole truth is, I got a disorder in a disorderly society. That's the whole truth. And that disorderly society created the condition for my mental disorder. That I didn't invent crime. That this is a criminal society. That I didn't fall in love with money on my own. That I live in a society where money is a measure of humanity. You got to contextualize things. Now, what do I mean when I say that the black dialogue has been perverted where we don't even talk ethically anymore? We end up apologizing to the white man for what he did to us. You know, in the 60s, we were clear. Our main emphasis was social justice. But the right wing got a jump on Roger Wilkins, Ben Hook, John Jacobs, and he got them answering him. And even talking about blacks do got a problem, and nobody is talking about the demand for social justice. So that the most definitive, now I want you to hear this, of all I said, this is it. The most definitive dialogue in the country today about black people is on black pathology. Tell me it's not. Whether you go among nationalists or liberal people, the most widespread, deep, enduring discussion about black people is on their pathology. Why is that so? Why can't we talk about the pathology and talk about social justice at the same time? Why can't we see the link between pathology and the pathological social condition that created it? Last thing. I'm writing a thing on Malcolm, the ethical philosophy of Malcolm, called Malcolm X and the Critique of Domination, Race, Class, and Human Dimensions. And in this discussion of humanism, I'm arguing that Malcolm was more of a humanist when he called the white man the devil when he didn't. Now, that's cold, ain't it? Don't that sound like, ooh, that's rough, Marlana? Malcolm was a religious man. In religion, you got two major powers, God and the devil. A humanist, listen now, shows his commitment or her commitment not by coming to terms with the white man, but by criticizing evil and the embodiment of evil wherever they see it. All restraints on human freedom and development must come under attack. And those who are the chief perpetuators of it must get the bulk of the criticism. In other words, they must bear the weight of their own history. Do you understand that? Now, what the white man says and what the Negroes whisper along with him, it only after Malcolm comes back from Mecca is he truly humanistic. That's not so. That means humanism depends upon us coming to terms with the white man. That's the only thing happened, you understand, to Malcolm from Mecca, was that he said, all right, maybe Whitey has a chance. Did you hear that? So we're going to base Malcolm's whole philosophy on his coming to terms, our evaluation of his philosophy, on coming to terms with the white man. What a great injustice. Marx, Schopenhauer, Montesquieu, as Jake said this morning. Dr. Carruthers told you all, Hegel, all these great white men who claim humanism never came to terms with three-fourths of the world's population. And yet they're called humanists. Is there something? And we got a group, I think it's racism, to claim you are more in contact with God than anybody else. And you got the right to savage everybody. Do you understand? Let me tell you one last thing about this whole Israel thing. Now, most of y'all read the Bible, and if you haven't, you read it. You know, don't drop it yet. Look, listen to what's happening here. Let's put Malcolm in contact as a fire prophet. You ever read Isaiah? You ever read Jeremiah? They talk about the Jews like they had tails. And nobody said Jeremiah is out of line. When Malcolm does it, he's a race hater. What's wrong here? Prophets talk like that. And they're supposed to use very hard and severe language. And Malcolm had an ethical philosophy. Sooner or later, we'll know him. Now, Kemet's greatest spiritual legacy is morality. Our greatest spiritual legacy, our greatest legacy to this country, and the greatest legacy of Kemet is spirituality. Do you see the tie here? This is ours, and it's theirs. But since we're the same people, why is that alarming? The problem is we haven't made the connection as deeply as we should because we haven't studied and absorbed the text. And what I want to do is talk about studying and absorbing the text. There are three reasons, however, why Kemet's rich heritage and legacy was not recognized until recently by more people. First of all, there was a generally racist and culturally chauvinist tendency to treat foreign cultures as inferior cultures in terms of the European. This means that they would refuse status and worth to both the culture and religion of other people. If it didn't fit within the Judeo-Christian framework, it was considered savage or heathen, remember? Pagan or something like that. So Egypt was denounced like that. People were talking about, Egyptians running around there with bird heads and vulture heads and, you know what I mean, all that. Now that looks strange if you're intolerant of religion. I teach religious tolerance. I teach tolerance for Christianity, tolerance for Islam, tolerance for Buddhism. But I first teach tolerance for myself. And I have to impose tolerance on the Christian and the Jew by reminding them of strange things in their own beliefs. If his head looks funny. Did you hear what I said? If a bird, horse's hawk head looks funny to the outside person, so does passing around pieces of bread, calling somebody's body, and drinking people's blood. Wait a minute. I want to hurry up and get this over so you know I'm not savaging this, okay? I can look at that and call it with tolerance and understand what the Christians call it, the Eucharist. Or if they get on my nerves and try to tell me I'm a pagan, I call it a prehistoric vestigial practice from the days of cannibalism. I could do that. So in order so we won't savage each other, let's admit that all of us got things going on other people can't understand because they're not in the context. And because we are at a point in human history where tolerance is not the value it should be. Do you understand?
So let us be honest. The whites have not done good by Egypt and made people take symbolism for substance. Also, the reason they haven't brought up Kemet is, you know, is the obvious debt that Judeo-Christianity owes to Kemet and the inability of Europe to concede this because of two things. First, its effect on their religious claims. If you got it from Egypt, then you can't complain you got it from God before they did. If you're going to keep up the argument that Moses took the Ten Commandments from the rock, you can't say they were already in the Book of Common Prayer by day. If you're going to say Solomon is the wisest man, you can't admit he got most of his wisdom from Amenemope, who lived 300 years before him, in which even the Christians in seminary school learn, if they are real critical. And you can't say that Messiah or Christ is just a word that belongs to Christianity, because in the Book of Nefertiti, there's already a Messiah. And Diop tells us in Civilization of Barbarism that Kershaw is already a word that is the origin of the word Christ and means keeper and stainers of the mysteries. Another reason they couldn't accept, of course, is a racial and culture claim. It claimed you were first and did everything. You can't then turn around and say the people we say were last did everything. And then finally, people have done well by Egyptian religion and spirituality because the people who studied were essentially archaeologists or historians that didn't have a critical, ethical, or religious mind. I repeat, there is no Kemetic legacy greater than its spiritual and ethical legacy. And I want to discuss that legacy in terms of its meaning and value for us today, for society, and for the world. I would concentrate on ethics because this spiritual discipline is key to our liberation and beginning to practice a high level of human life. The fundamental concept in ancient Egyptian spirituality is Ma. The Husil teaches that Ra laid the foundation of the world through Ma, that God lives in Ma, that God is pleased by righteousness, that the nature of God, or Ra, is righteousness. He lives through Mat and is pleased by Mat. Thus, as Dr. Carruthers states, quote, Mat is more often encountered in an ethical context, but as a conceptualization, it transcends the bounds of human interaction and becomes the foundation for cosmic direction. Also, as I've said elsewhere, Mat is a divine concept, power, and practice which not only informed and aided Ra's creative action, but was established as a fundamental concept, power, and practice for the organization, maintenance, and development, not only of the world, but of human society. Mat is posed as both a central spiritual task and a reward for human life. In the Book of Kununu tells us, quote, do Mat for the Lord of Mat, whose might is fully Mat, or do justice, or do truth for the Lord of truth and justice, whose truth and justice is truly truth and justice. Kununu continues saying, Mat is for eternity and goes to the grave with those who do it. Thus he encourages us to speak Mat and do Mat, for might is mighty, mighty. It is great, it endures, its worth is real, and it leads one to blessedness. Wrongdoing, he says, does not achieve its goal, but one who is righteous reaches dry land. Moreover, all the ancient sable moral teachers from Imhotep through Pebhor taught the value and correctness and reward of Mat. Ptahotep taught that Mat is great, its value is lasting, and it has remained unchanged and unchallenged, unequaled and unchanged, rather, since the time of the Creator. It lies as a plain path, the Book of Ptahotep says, it lies as a plain path even before the ignorant, and those who violate its law are punished. And this is a statement to people who say, well, wicked's getting away with everything. But Husil said, although wickedness may gain wealth, wrongdoing has never brought his wares to a safe port. In the end, it is Mat that endures, that is righteousness. And in the end, it is Mat that endures and enables the upright to say, it is the legacy of my father and mother. The alternative translation of that is the ground of my father and mother. It is a solid place, the foundation upon which my mother and father stood, and my mother and father, their mother and father before them. My then is seen as that which gives us grounding. Patel also says, established are those who stand at his mind, who walk according to his way. They shall surely prosper thereby, but the greedy shall have not even the grave. My then is established order, put together by Ra, and we're called upon by the Hosea to preserve it and restore it and enrich it. Okay? Now, the central principle, I repeat, is might. But how does might express itself, and what grounds does it offer as compelling ethical ground? Might is rooted in and reflected in what we call a philosophical anthropology. By philosophical anthropology, I mean a conception of man and woman. Okay? That's what I mean. An elaborate conception of man and woman that talks about their worth, their origin, and where they tend toward. So that might is rooted in and reflected in a philosophical anthropology that conceives of the human personality in several critical ways. First, the first contention of the philosophical anthropology of might is that we are in the divine image of God. Okay, I know you heard this before in Christianity. I'm talking thousands of years before. They call this imago Dei, in the image of God. Ketty says it. Humans are in his image and came forth from his body. Moreover, Ketty says, he made the sky and earth for their sake. In other words, not only are we in his image, but he gives us preference. That puts a heavy weight on our shoulder. If we are gods and goddesses in our own right, then that teaches us an ethics different from the ethics of a slave that says, servant, be obedient to your master. Do you understand that now? That's why if you read the Hosea, it's not the ethics of a conquered people. It is not the ethics of a whipped down people. It's the ethics of a people self-conscious of its relationship with God, with the order of the universe. Therefore, it talks bold. You are a God and the son and daughter of a God. Your head shall not be taken from you, even as the head of God was not taken from him. You shall rise like rock. That's a different kind of ethics than one that says, hey, try to adjust. Be faithful over these few things you got, and you can get a little bit more. It says, dare take back your fame. Dare take your legacy. Raise images above the earth that reflect your capacity for human and divine greatness. It makes a black man that's shooting dope in his arm see himself in a different way. He's no longer a nigger in somebody else's shadow, but a self-conscious agent of his own liberation. He has a heritage to maintain. And until we teach this kind of ascending ethics, we're in serious trouble. Second thing about the philosophical anthropology is that it teaches a dual truth of the human personality, of human nature. That is to say, human nature in Mighty and philosophy has two tendencies, an ascended tendency and a descended tendency. A God tendency, the righteous tendency of might. But it also has an evil tendency, or a negative tendency, the tendency of Isfah. This tendency is found in the book of contemplation, especially this dual nature, rather, is found in the book of dialogue of a man with his soul, in which the person writes, to whom shall I speak today? People willingly accept the evil, and good is cast to the ground everywhere. The one doing wrong is an intimate friend, and the brother and sister with whom one used to deal has now become an enemy. That recognizes that humans can do evil, but they can also be divine. Third, the dual truth here then is in fact the dual truth of possibility. Possibility for evil and good. And then the fourth thing is that given this reality, that only through wise and righteous instruction can the best be cultivated and reinforced to extract the good and to extract the good from us and destroy the evil. So instruction here is key. Patel Tef says, teach your children to hear well. Respected are those who listen well. They will surely excel and their deeds will distinguish them. Pepperhorse says it is a son and daughter's advantage and good fortune to receive instruction and ask for it. Those who are steadfast and thoughtful are chosen among the people, and those who listen to a correction protect themselves from receiving another. Surely the fault in every kind of character lies in not listening. Let me just say that again. Surely the fault in every kind of character lies in not listening. In other words, not willingly receiving instruction. Because only by knowing can we act correctly. Only by knowing correctly, knowing the truth, can we live and speak the truth. The God of wisdom has placed a stick on earth, Pepperhorse says. Listen to this now. This is for the bloods. The God of wisdom has placed a stick on earth in order to teach the fool by means of it. But he has given the wise a sense of shame in order to avoid all punishment. Stick for the hard-headed. A sense of shame for those who wish to avoid all punishment. The hard-head needs to take poison to know it kills. It's enough for the wise to hear reports. Key here is the power, the infinite power of instruction and the unlimited faith that the ancient Egyptians had in the malleability, the moldability of the human personality. See, this is against all that philosophical anthropology the white man created in the 17th and 18th century, where he said man is evil. But also that's rooted in Judeo-Christian concept too, that we all, as Jonathan Edwards said, we all born in sin, hanging by a hair string or whatever. That's a rough concept. I can't handle that. You know what I mean? I can accept honor your father and mother, don't kill. You know, that's in my tradition. But to believe I'm evil by nature, and only by the grace of a God that made me evil by nature, can I ever escape? But that's self-hatred on the white man. It's a self-portrait. Do you understand that? I can't be in the image of God and evil by nature at the same time. And the ethics that sees, or that has a philosophical anthropology that teaches that man is evil by nature, that woman is a harlot standing in the door, smooth lips but an end as bitter as wormwood. An ethics that teaches that has a whole different approach to the human personality. Do you understand that? Do you understand? A religion that teaches that view of humans has a different approach to ethics, is what I really mean. So the word might means many things. But if one wanted to find one word for it, I would choose righteousness, for both its broadness and inclusiveness in the realm of spirituality and ethics. Righteousness, however, in Matian ethic, expresses itself as seven cardinal virtues, which you've heard me lecture on before, and I'm going to do them, but I'll do them quicker. Seven cardinal virtues. Why seven? Why not 50 million? Well, why 10 commandments? There's a lot of commandments out there. Why they line up 10? See what I mean? Don't do that. Because seven is manageable, and because it has a spiritual significance, but also because all seven of these words can be translated as might, and might can be translated as thee. In other words, in the text, when they talk about might, they're talking about these seven things. True. More than any other thing, even though the other thing, like there are three other supplementary, what I call enabling virtues, that also form might, but only these seven or close to the translation of what might is. Truth, justice, propriety, harmony, balance, order, and reciprocity. And the three enabling virtues, which I'm going to discuss in the context of the seven, are humbleness, that you need in order to understand you need some virtue. Yeah. Self-mastery or discipline, which you're going to have to even get the virtue. And then service, which is the fundamental expression of the virtue. Service is key to ancient Egyptian ethic. Okay, now, because in the final analysis, as in all African ethic, our spirituality is practical. It's what you do to yourself and each other that determines the level of your spirituality. All right? So by virtue, I mean a quality of excellence. The thrust here is to endow the human personality with qualities of excellence so that we practice might, absorb might, and become one with it. In the final analysis, to live the law truly and fully is to become the law. You know the hope inherent in Matian philosophy is that you won't need laws because you will be the law. That inherent in you is the capacity to be truth, to be walking justice. See, we take names. You ever notice how we have African names that mean things like that? Truth, justice. That's a historical hope that you will become that. Do you understand? All through the Pharaoh's text, the king's text, you see that he represents and embodies might. He is one with it. He is the law. He's the living law. He becomes the ideal person, the paradigm for human possibility. But think of that. The reason blacks resist law and discipline so much is because they're at odds with the law. But suppose they were the law. No need to resist in your own nature. Might is law, and when you're one with law, it is no longer law, it's nature. Do you understand that? When you're one with truth, it's no longer the law of truth, it's the nature of truth. The ideal person was a Gedu, or a Gedu Mat, a self-mastered righteous man who expressed and embodied these seven virtues. And as I said, in the Hosea, you have the book of Declaration of Virtue, which expressed how these were put in social life. Let me just say one or two things about each of those virtues. The first virtue is the virtue of truth. Did you hear that? The virtue of truth. Why start with truth? Why not start with justice? Well, if you don't start with truth, you don't even know what justice is. The functioning of the sky. Study the functioning of the earth. Study everything. Don't say I'm wise, but set yourself to become that way. Do you understand that? So what is the first truth? The first truth is truth of self. Isn't that right? You all say that, don't you? Know thyself. A brother told me that in the spirituality commission. He said, I thought that was a fundamental principle of mine. Know thyself. I said, yeah, it is, but it's in the context of a virtue called truth. Knowing the truth of yourself. What is the truth of yourself? What is the truth of yourself? The first truth is that you are in a divine image. The second is you got a dual tendency. And even though you're divine, you got a little wrongdoing, too, you could do. Do you understand? So you won't get confused. I remember I used to get confused in the 60s. Muhammad, the messenger of Allah, used to teach all the time that, you know, the black man is righteous by nature. And I couldn't understand that the blood is righteous by nature. Why keep killing and shooting that dope? Why are we rolling them dice so much where he lose everything he got? You could always say, well, you know, they done tricked him and turned him. But no, the fact is they couldn't play on that. If we didn't have the dual truth, that the dual character of our nature, where one can be cultivated and the other deformed. Do you understand that? So you got to realize this truth. Then you won't lie to yourself. Then you will act against the negative, root it out. It's like Jake says, it's not enough to do truth or do might. You got to destroy Isfit. And you start by destroying the Isfit in you. That's one of our pledges, is that we destroy that in us, which is in contradiction to the values we have and the choice we've made. Do you understand that? So that's the second truth. The third one is the need for knowledge and instruction. The willingness, do you hear that? To listen and to learn. And then the fourth truth of self is that self is not an isolated being. That self can only be defined truly and in the final analysis as self in community. The white man has personal, individual, and society. And never the twain shall meet. Yeah. Ours is person in community. Do you understand that? That I get my idea of myself from the people around me. That's why if I wake up and call myself a nigger, it ain't really just my fault. It's the niggas around me that taught me to be a nigger. Do you understand that? They've already defined themselves as niggers. Do you understand? And that's their legacy to me. Do you understand that? It's the blood that put me on, nigger. All, see, that guy had told me that so much, and I said, well, you too, nigger. You see, so we became reciprocal niggas. You know what I mean? Each one of us denying the humanity and divinity of the other. And what is a nigger anyhow but a social construction of the white man? A person who is devoid of historical memory and has a problem conceiving of himself except bending over backwards to give evil a great gap in the opening.